With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the application window is open for the Colorado River Waters Leader Program, and agriculture saw more than $2.4 billion in weather damage in 2023. We'll have more. But our top story today, rumors have been circulating for months about a possible spinoff of Bayer's Crop Sciences division. Brent Boydston, the corn, cereal grains, digital agriculture, and carbon lead at Bayer Crop Science, was a speaker at an expo in North Dakota this week, and while taking questions from the audience, he addressed the speculation.
So what you may have seen in the news, there was some ag trade media that published some stories on whether Bayer was going to be split off, whether we're going to be spun off, sold, all those kind of things. Those were a repackage of, you, if you will, of previous comments that our new CEO has made. When Werner Baumann was the CEO, he retired. We have a new gentleman named Bill Anderson. He came in. He took over in January, effectively took over in April. And one of the first questions he got asked during one of his first meetings was, and it was with the investors, was he going to spin things off? There's some activist investor pressure to do different things, and he made the comment of, nothing's on the table, nothing's off the table. I'm going to go through, I'm going to look at it, we're going to see where we go and see what makes sense to do. And he has been very much on that strategy, and he was in a public setting, and the question came up again. He reiterated his points, and the media said, hey, here's what's going on. It's still being evaluated. Right now, there doesn't seem to be any interest in spinning anything off. We are going under a whole new management structure where we're getting, he wants to implement it because it's going to produce a lot of savings. It's going to cut down on the bureaucracy. It's going to make the decisions much quicker. So he's dedicated to getting that through the process and then likely reevaluating things then. But right now, everything that I've seen, everything that I've heard says that Bayer's going to stay one company. We're going to be consumer, we're going to be crop science, and we're going to be health.
Boydston was recently elected chairman of the board of directors for the U.S. Grains Council. During his remarks, he talked about several megatrends in agriculture, and one of those trends is sustainable aviation fuel. He says it has big, big potential for agriculture.
Alcohol to jet is ready to go right now. I will admit it's a little on the pricey side just because it's not as widely available as just your true ethanol, but alcohol to jet, it's a drop-in fuel that's ready to go right now. And to give you an idea of a scale, in January, Grains Council opened an office in Delhi, India. We're the first cooperator group, first market group to have an office in Delhi, India. When we came back, we were on a 787, Boeing's new plane, uber efficient. That plane carried 38,000 gallons of jet fuel. To put that in context, a friend of mine told me that on their farm, in 1 year's time, they used 51,000 gallons. So 365 days and 51,000 gallons of diesel fuel, one flight for 17 hours, 38,000 gallons of jet fuel. So that's to give you an idea of the scale of what SAF could mean for agriculture. But there are some things that have to come in that I think U.S. agriculture is very well positioned to deal with. When you're looking at the carbon intensity score, this is what things are hinging around right now. We can talk more about the U.S. GREET model versus the what the Europeans use, but there is big, big potential there.
He also talked about the current regulatory environment in Washington, D.C. regarding the Environmental Protection Agency and crop protection products. Boydston was asked whether a challenge lies ahead in approving new chemicals for use or protecting the availability of chemicals that are currently approved for the market.
With what we're seeing with, and I should say, EPA is doing a very good job of trying to get things, getting those new registrations through the process. However, they've lost people. The group that does this now has about 400 people in it. That's down, I think, from 900 that it used to be. So they have lost over half of the staff that they had to approve these new products and approve the re-registration of these products. Because once you register a product, it's not in perpetuity. You have to re-register it every so often. And so you have a staff that is incredibly overworked because of staff shortages, And you also have a staff that knows no matter what they do, it's going to end up in a lawsuit. So I think that's going to add to the length of time. You know, you get into the VSPP, how is that going to play in? So everything, whether it's a new product or re-registration, I think it's all going to become infinitely longer.
He also commented on the current regulatory environment surrounding gene editing.
Where the regulations fall down will determine where this technology goes. You know, in the United States, USDA, FDA, EPA, they all have oversight over this technology. They all have to look at it through various different frames. FDA, how it impacts human health, EPA, because some of these products are going to be producing crop protectants that would be under FIFRA, and then USDA, how does it fit into the plant health? So there's different government entities that are having to look at this. They are looking at it. You know, right now, EPA has finalized their PIP rule, which was in 2023. USDA, they looked at it through Part 340. I have not heard if FDA has done anything since then. The EU framework was published in July. I think there's some tweaks that could be done there. And then secondary standards that we're going to be seeing coming. From when we say downstreams, these would be our trading partners, not main trading partners, but trading partners that are important nonetheless, that are not quite as far down the path of these approvals. So like I said, the regulatory environment will dictate the potential for agriculture of the gene editing that we're starting to see.
That was Brent Boydston, the Corn, Cereal, Grains, Digital Agriculture, and Carbon Lead at Bayer Crop Science. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will return in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report, when we come back. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's national spotlight, commodity brokers and analysts react to recent news related to Brazil's soybean crops from USDA reports to the latest weather events. Here's Rod Bain with more.
Among the highlights from USDA's November World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, the 2 million ton jump in global soybean production adjustment in the prior marketing year, fueled by a projected Brazilian bean production increase of the same amount. That should carry over to a record soybean production in the South American nation in the 2023-24 marketing year. And as Don Roos of U.S. Commodities Incorporated told farm broadcasters recently, as among industry traders and brokers looking at this situation,
it's all about South America. Between Argentina and Brazil, they raise about twice as many soybeans as we do, to put it in perspective. If they have a problem, we have a problem.
However, recent rains after months of dry weather, coupled with increased production from neighboring country Argentina, is expected to limit exports by the globe's largest bean producer. That gained the attention of commodity traders shortly after the WASDE, leading to a market rally. Roos explains the concept of a weather market.
Usually weather markets are very fast. They're 4 to 6 weeks in length. You're in or out, and they're up or down, and you get a little bit of a setback. But that's what we're focused on right now, and that's what we're in, flat out, a weather market. And I think we'll realize that each weekend as we go forwards. I think this is just the start of it.
Broker Tommy Grisafi emphasizes that the movement in soybean markets is standalone from other commodities.
It is a soybean rally. It is not a bull market in corn. It's not a bull market in wheat. We have a lot of grain on the world market, and it's going to take an incredible amount of energy to keep that market up. With everything happening in the world, this feels like a gift and an opportunity for American producers to hedge a South American problem.
Commodity analyst Mike Zazulo acknowledges while the soybean commodity market rally is a weather-driven one.
We, in our trade, have been living off of weather supply-led rallies. Very hard to market in. Very hard to control the volatility and the risk management side of the equation.
There are also signals and questions whether Brazil has present ability to meet demand from customers such as China. That is due in part to the weather shift of recent rains in several key Brazilian soybean growing areas. That eases crop concerns, yet may hamper shipments out of that nation's pork complexes. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Randall Wiseman with today's Livestock Report.
Well, in today's livestock news, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced this week they are waiving certain notice of loss requirements for 2023 for the Emergency Assistance for Livestock, Honeybees, and Farm-Raised Fish, otherwise known as ELAP, and the Livestock Indemnity Program, known as LIP. This move is an effort to streamline assistance to support access to critical 2023 natural disaster recovery assistance. USDA's Farm Service Agency is actually waiving the requirement to submit ELAP or LIP notice of loss within a predetermined number of days for this year. Instead, producers have the flexibility to submit 2023 notices of loss as soon as possible once losses are realized following a natural disaster event or no later than the established annual program application for payment deadlines for each program. FSA county committees are also being asked to reevaluate 2023 ELAP and LIP late filed notices of loss to determine if the waiver applies. Now, ELAP does provide recovery assistance to eligible producers of livestock, honeybee, and farm-raised fish losses due to an eligible adverse weather or loss condition. That includes blizzards, disease, water shortages, and wildfires. It also covers grazing and feed losses, transportation of water and feed to livestock, and hauling livestock to grazing acres. LIP provides disaster recovery assistance to livestock owners and contract growers who experience livestock deaths in excess of normal mortality caused by an eligible loss conditions, including adverse weather, disease, and attacks by animals. To learn more about LIP or ELAP, simply contact FSA at your local USDA service center. Well, if you think beef cattle prices are high right now, just wait until next year. Gary Crawford has the story.
The number of cattle, especially heifers, being sent to slaughter or to feedlots has continued to increase over the last few months, and one analyst says, of course,
higher cow slaughter and higher placements now, it just means that even further down the line, it's going to continue to tighten up supplies.
So much so that for 2024, USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jekanowski says,
what we are expecting to see for the coming year is a fairly sharp reduction year over year in beef production, so down about a billion pounds.
Or about a 4% decline in production at 25.8 billion pounds. And that, of course, is likely to bring on what Mark calls
really very historically high steer prices.
USDA currently projecting steer prices next year to average almost $185 a hundredweight. That would be up 4% from the already high prices we've been seeing this year. Consumer beef prices are already running about 9% higher than a year ago. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary, and it's been a pleasure to bring you livestock news through this AgNet West program for the past few years, but it's time I turn the reins over to a newer voice, as starting Monday, December 4th, Will Jordan, a young man you've heard report various stories over the past few months, will take over. So, for the final time, I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Del Monte Foods Incorporated has pledged $5 million over the next decade to enhance the physical, mental, and emotional well-being of youth and communities in the United States. Aligned with its Growers of Good purpose to make nutritious foods more accessible, the commitment includes support for various organizations and a partnership with the Alliance for a Healthier Generation. Through the Nourishing Families by Nourishing Schools program, the collaboration aims to reach 7.5 million students and families. Focused on K-12 schools, especially in under-resourced areas, the initiative seeks to improve overall health through nutrition education, resources, and content. Del Monte Foods President and CEO Greg Longstreet said they're excited to team up with Healthier Generation to bring family education and nutrition resources to schools as an evidence-based approach to improving the overall health of young people. There's just over a month left to apply for the Discrimination Financial Assistance Program available from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The deadline for the program was extended from October 31st to January 13th, 2024. The extension aims to provide eligible farmers, ranchers, and forest landowners with additional time to apply for assistance. The extension allowed for expanded outreach efforts, including direct technical assistance and training sessions to better inform and support applicants. The program, mandated by the Inflation Reduction Act, allocates $2.2 billion to offer financial assistance to those who experience discrimination in USDA farm lending programs before January 2021. The amount awarded depends on the number of eligible applicants and the impact of discrimination. Applicants can apply online or submit paper-based forms via mail or in person to local program offices. California grapes took a multi-billion-dollar hit this year from weather damages. Director of Government and Public Policy for the California Fresh Fruit Association, Adam Borcher, detailed the impacts from spring rains and Hurricane Hillary later in the season.
Consistent with other storm events and other natural disasters, the county ag commissioners did an excellent job of going out and reaching out to production ag to get an estimate of crop and cost impacts. And at least for Kern County on grape production for both table and wine grapes, we're looking at approximately $532 million in impacts just in Kern County alone. And that's part of the $2.4 billion that California Ag has seen in terms of storm-related impacts going back to January 1st. So not just in the Central Valley, but in Salinas and other ag production areas around the state.
The historic year for citrus thrip damage is thought to have several different causes. Some growers are reporting as much as 60% damage related to thrips. BASF Tech Service Rep for the Southern San Joaquin Valley, Kevin Caffrey, said multiple factors contributed to the significant thrip pressures this year, one of which being a secondary impact of no longer having a material available.
And a lot of things the citrus industry is still facing on pest pressure is they are now starting to get the secondary effects of the loss of Lorsban. So for years, Lorsban was controlling a lot of pests that they never thought were pests because Lorsban would just control them. Now that that broad chemistry is no longer being used, your mealybugs, your cotton cushion scales, even your citricola scales are getting far worse. And there's some pests that were most likely being controlled for years and just always were a pest, but never as bad as they're getting now because they were being controlled with other products.
The application window is now open for the Colorado River Water Leaders Program, which will run from March to September of next year. The biennial program, part of the Colorado River Project, is patterned after the highly successful California Water Leaders Program. It brings together individuals from the seven states that rely on the river, California, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, Wyoming, Utah, and New Mexico, to take part in a cohort. During the seven-month program designed for working professionals, the cohort members explore issues surrounding the river, deepen their water knowledge, and build leadership skills. A virtual Q&A session is scheduled for December 7th, and applications for the program are due January 22, 2024. More information about the program is available at watereducation.org/specialized-programs. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Several U.S. farm representatives are on hand during the United Nations Climate Change Conference to express agriculture's important role in climate mitigation efforts. Rob LaRue of the National Farmers Union tells us about some of the opportunities for himself and other ag producers.
We'll have a number of opportunities, both through our direct involvement as a member of the World Farmer Organization, which is a global body, and there will be different panels, everything related to regenerative agriculture and additional ways that farmers, either through past experiences with carbon banks and so forth, can be part of that. We also will be engaged in the daily meetings with the broader farming community there, known as the farmer constituency, which is, again, another direct pipeline, hopefully, to influencing world conversations around climate to talk about the concerns that we have.
The conference is underway in Dubai. This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. What sort of food price inflation situation will shoppers see in 2024? Gary Crawford has the latest forecast from an expert.
Ah, yes, here's a familiar piece of music, the Indiana Jones theme. Yes, Indiana Jones, always on the dangerous hunt to acquire priceless ancient antiquities and artifacts and encountering all kinds of adventures along the way. And when you think about it, the last couple of years, in a way, have turned many food shoppers into everyday Indiana Joneses, always on the search for sometimes rare and pricey food items among the perils of rising food price inflation. Oh yes, food shopping has been an adventure of sorts. In 2022, we had to figure out our food budgets while seeing overall grocery prices rising an average of 11.5%. Normally, food prices go up only about 2% a year. So in 2022, we see an 11.5% price hike. And this year, it looks like we shoppers have had to cope with another 5% price hike on top of last year's big price surge. However, maybe things will be getting better in 2024. Some experts say we food shoppers will likely see a slowdown in food price inflation at the grocery store.
But we don't expect food prices to decline overall in 2024.
However, here's what Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer does expect for 24.
We expect food at home or grocery prices to increase by 1.6%.
That would be below that historical norm we talked about earlier of about a 2% yearly food price hike. Megan says price increases should return to below normal levels for a number of food products next year.
Some of those categories are fish and seafood, dairy products, fruits and vegetables, cereals and bakery products, and also eggs. We expect egg prices to decline in 2024, though there have recently been new cases of avian influenza detected in egg layers recently. So we'll be closely monitoring that going forward.
And right now, it looks like pork prices next year will actually come in lower than this year. So, Megan, why this low food price forecast?
Largely, it's that some of the challenges that the food system and food prices we're experiencing have started to work themselves out.
Challenges such as COVID-19 and the supply chain problems that came from that. World wheat markets have settled down after the initial shock from the war in Ukraine. And this year, we've seen very few outbreaks of bird flu in U.S. poultry flocks. Cross your fingers on that one. So maybe, just maybe, next year, food shopping will not be so much of an adventure. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
USDA and the U.S. Agency for International Development have joined forces in a program that gives youth in Tanzania agricultural mapping skills and a way to enter a potential ag career. Rod Bain reports.
Crop data, whether it's weather, crop condition, crop model information, or any number of agricultural statistics, these data resources are useful and in many cases can stand alone. That's according to Lisa Colson, a geographer with USDA's Foreign Agricultural Service. Yet,
that information is only as valuable as the degree to which we understand where the crops are grown, when they are planted, and when they are harvested.
Translation, eyes on the ground, field enumerators and assessors that can see crop conditions firsthand with satellite imagery.
So sometimes we know, broadly speaking, cotton is grown in a specific region of a country. That country might be Tanzania. But during a severe drought, has the farmer decided to switch and grow a different crop that year to try to minimize using water-intensive crop like cotton in their production?
FAS staff contribute to field observations and data used in USDA information sets, such as the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates, although Colson acknowledges time limitations for staff. Recently,
we were approached by USAID, the International Agency for Development, asking us if there is some sort of agricultural project we could do with this group called Youth Mappers. And we immediately thought of this challenge we have, that we need that ground truth data. We need that direct observation of where a crop is being grown during different time periods of the season.
Colson mentioned the African nation of Tanzania earlier, as it was the location of a pilot program involving 14 youth mappers, university students in Tanzania that are part of a global network of chapters participating in mapping activities in response to local and global development needs. These students gathered various data on grain, oilseed, and cotton crops in over 300 fields in the Arusha area of the country, with such information including photographs, georeferencing, and identification of target crops. As FAS's Luke Nye explains,
this pilot project is a great example of how FAS can work with local partners as well as with U.S. universities to be able to put together this program and to use an existing technology, existing infrastructure, and existing network and to be able to tweak it for agricultural purposes.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
As the seasons shift, ensuring optimal ventilation becomes a crucial consideration for colder climate farmers in maintaining healthy livestock during winter. Livestock Controlled Environments Extension Specialist with University of Wisconsin, Nestle Ogden, says ventilation in winter isn't just about keeping animals warm, it's about safeguarding their health. There are a few different challenges that come with winter barn ventilation.
In winter, we want to make sure that there is enough air exchange to prevent the accumulation of moisture, dust, ammonia, maybe pathogens that may cause health problems in animals. So this is one challenge. How do we do it? Another challenge is in winter, we lower the ventilation rates, and then we are providing only a little bit fresh air inside the barn and distributing this fresh air evenly to each stall or pen in a calf barn is a challenge. So in calf barns, sometimes we use solid panels to prevent rust and cold stress. So we want to make sure that each pen receives some fresh air, even in winter.
There are two types of ventilation that farmers can use. She talks about deciding which is best.
It really depends on the design of the barn. If it is a mechanically ventilated building, if there are no side curtains, then they can only lower their ventilation rates. But some of them are designed as a hybrid. So if there are curtains, I think it is a good idea to have the natural ventilation in winter.
During the winter, it's important to calculate the proper air exchange in a barn to prevent the buildup of moisture or ammonia.
So our golden rule is 4 to 6 air exchanges per hour. So it really depends on the volume of the barn. But we recommend to have a minimum of 4 air exchanges per hour. So the whole barn air should change 4 times in 1 hour. So we need to make sure it is happening to have enough or good air quality inside the barn.
Having these systems in place isn't enough. Proper maintenance is also key to preventing ventilating bad air to your animals.
So dust accumulation may reduce the fan efficiency 30%. So when we were thinking that we are providing enough air, we may not be providing enough air to the barn.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. For today's interview segment, I'm talking with Executive Vice President for Policy Development and Strategy for the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council, Jaime Castaneda, and we're talking about the decision in the dairy dispute between the U.S. and Canada. Here is our conversation. I wanted to talk today about the decision that was made about Canada's dairy quotas, and it was not the decision that the U.S. dairy industry was hoping for. Basically, the ruling this time went to Canada. Can you just tell my listeners a little bit about the ruling and how it came about?
Yeah, sure. So as most of your folks in the dairy world and even agriculture in general know that Canada, the government of Canada has a sort of a two-phase when it comes to trade. It has, when it's talking about grains and livestock, cattle, they're very pro-export and free traders. But when it comes to dairy, it's the most protectionist country in the world. So dairy has supply management in Canada, and it is very difficult to try to get them to open their markets. So when we renegotiated USMCA, the previous administration, the dairy industry was very strong about making sure that whatever Canada was going to give us, it was going to be a real, true market access. Time passed, and the little that the previous administration negotiated, which again, is we're not talking about an open, free market like most of our free trade agreements are. If you look at all our free trade agreements, sometimes it would take several years, but at the end of the day, we would actually have free trade, so open market. With Canada, the negotiations would allow only a close to less than 3% of the Canadian market access, and it was with a lot of whistles and bells that actually you cannot do this and you cannot do that and so on. But one thing that actually everybody understood was that what it was given, we were going to be able to ship into Canada. Then you move forward to now when Canada implemented USMCA, they gave the entire quota, the new quota, the small amount that actually we would actually have access to, they gave it to the processors. And obviously, this is like giving the chicken house to be protected by the fox, right? It is actually they're gonna import whatever they want. They're not gonna import anything that they compete against. So all the high-value products that we could actually be selling to retail and so on, they were not going to. So most of the quotas were never filled. So the United States complained and brought a case into Canada within the USMCA, and we won the first case. The problem was that the first case didn't go far enough to basically argue that Canada had to actually truly open their market and allow for a number of different players in Canada to be able to actually import, like retailers, food distributors, restaurants, pizza chains, and so on. Anyway, so that wasn't, so that's why, even though we won the first case, Canada make minor changes, and the United States decided that that wasn't enough, and they brought this second case. We honestly believe that we were going to have a wide win here. It was so clear that Canada was inconsistent with their obligations. But this is why it is so complex and appealing that the panel would rule in favor of the country that it is failing to fulfill their commitment.
You know, and that was one of my biggest questions is, how do you think they came to this decision? It seemed like there were some facts in this case that were pretty clear. There are trade agreements that are made for a reason. And from what I understand, Canada was not following what they were supposed to be doing in the agreement that they had. How can a decision like this come about, do you think?
It is a great question. And I wish actually we would have one of the lawyers that decided against the United States in your program so we can debate. Mm. But the lawyer would actually say, well, what happened is that you didn't specify that retailers and food distributors and had to be part of the inclusion of, you know, it's one of those things that you expect that you don't need to clarify that when you're basically saying, if you look at the text and it says that all members of the food sector should be allowed to actually participate. That's what the text said, but it didn't say, and that includes retailers, food distributors, restaurants, and so on. So the lawyer would tell you that, hey, you didn't specify, therefore I have to side with the criminal, right? With the one that it is. It's like when you, I don't know, if you ever see Law and Order or any of those law TV series in which, I mean, the criminal gets off by a technicality, that something wasn't followed through, even though everybody knew that he committed a crime. That's the case here. Everybody knows that Canada is playing a game. Everybody knows that they are actually not fulfilling their commitment. And the judge, in this case, the panel, two of them at least, ruled that that was okay.
You are listening to the Agnet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and I'm talking with the Executive Vice President for Policy Development and Strategy for the National Milk Producers Federation and the U.S. Dairy Export Council, Jaime Castaneda, and we're talking about the USMCA decision in favor of Canada. Let's continue the conversation. Where does this put U.S. dairy producers now? What's the most important thing that they need to know now?
Let me put it in perspective. I think that the market that we obtain, even though very, very, very small, was actually very important from the significance that was going to be to demonstrate the Canadian consumer, the ones that actually are traveling during Canada's winter to all the United States, you go to Florida, Arizona, anywhere, you're full of Canadians. So they know that they can actually have a number of different products here in the United States that they cannot have in Canada. I think that, again, we were not talking about huge quantities. But we were talking about the ability for certain key manufacturers of cheese and key producers of fluid milk or yogurt to be able to actually sell directly to their customers, like the Walmarts and Costcos of the world, or even the pizza chain. And I think that from the perspective of being able to actually finally go into Canada, into the Canadian market, allow the Canadians to actually not only buy those products here in the United States, but buy them in Canada, I think that has the greatest significance, not because of the huge volume, because there was not a huge volume, but the significance, the symbolic significance that was actually to get into the Canadian market. The other part that is extremely important for the farmers and the manufacturers, but the farmers, is that we keep telling them to have faith in the enforcement of trade. And for this panel to make this type of decision, very disturbing. It actually has a lot of consequences on the trust of this type of panels, in which they're going to side on the side of again, the one that is doing the wrong thing just because of technicality.
I like that you pointed out also that this does affect Canadians as well. If they come to the U.S. and are traveling through here, there are things that they can get that they won't be able to get when they're back home because of this decision as well. So it's not just us that it's affecting. Is there anything else that you think that our listeners need to know about this?
Sure, that certainly the National Milk Producers and the U.S. Dairy Export Council are going to work closely with the U.S. government and Congress to ensure that Canada doesn't get away with this type of action. Because it is not only the fact that they're not allowing us to fulfill the market access that they offer during the USMCA negotiations. But not only that, but if you understand the concept of supply management, which is to limit your supply so your farmers can have high prices, much, much higher than the United States, then you're not supposed to be exporting any product because you're supposed to actually control how much you're supplying, and that's why you're controlling your imports. Canada not only is not allowing us to actually export our products into Canada, what was negotiated, but they're dumping their excess protein. So when you have milk and you need the cream, so the fat, then you separate the cream and what you have left is protein, which is great, it's valuable. But then if you don't need it in your country, then you do something that is called milk protein concentrate. And you dump it into the United States or dump it into the world. So we are aware that Canada is doing this, and we also are bringing it to the attention of the United States. So not only the issue of market access, but the issue that they're dumping milk. So this is very serious, and we're not going to stop until we certainly see some action by the U.S. government that impacts what Canada is doing.
And then that would be my last question, is there a next step that you can take?
Well, there is a number of different options, and I would say that I'm not in the position right now because it would be something that will require a lot of conversations with the U.S. government and lawyers and so on, so and members of Congress to determine what the next steps are. But I can assure you that as soon as actually we know something, we can share with you and your audience. But we're going to be talking closely with the government.
That sounds good. So we will watch for more and see what happens next then.
Right. Absolutely.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Sure. Anytime, Sabrina.
That is today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgnetWest online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvorsen on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.